Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, this is Yannick Noah. Remember me? You're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Yes, welcome to Roland Garros Relived. Yannick Noah coming your way in what I would say is the most enthralling interview I've ever done, certainly one of the most enthralling interviews I've ever heard, quite frankly. Delighted to have it for you here on the Tennis Podcast in the first of 15 editions of Tennis Relived. Just before we get cracking with that, though, we had a quiz yesterday for our predictions level Kickstarter backers who don't have any live tennis to predict about. The goal for Catherine and Matt in setting it up was for me not to win, and they got their way because I came not first.
Not even second or third. It wasn't even a podium finish, which is
right.
really better than we even dreamed of, to borrow a phrase from Yannick Noah.
Yes. Who will be coming soon here on the first edition of Roland Garros Relived, which we will be bringing to you every single day throughout the 2 weeks that should have been the French Open. You two should have been in Paris right now. Sorry, I know that's rubbing it in. But we have the next best thing for you. We have this journey through the past, through the wonderful history of the sport. We're going to be doing the same during Wimbledon. And we have a wonderful exclusive interview with Yannick Noah today to take us through 1983. So lots to look forward to. Congratulations to Daryl, the champion of the quiz yesterday. I say that through gritted teeth, but fair enough. He won fair and square.
Yeah, that was the added element of perfection, really, that Daryl is David's university mate. So not only was he was beaten by the one person who he absolutely wanted to beat himself.
Yeah, former mate would be more accurate. So let's get cracking on something more jolly, shall we? 1983, Yannick Noah against Mats Wilander in the men's singles final of Roland Garros. In 1983, seatbelts became mandatory in the UK. The first mobile phones were introduced to the public. Cabbage Patch dolls were introduced. Do you remember Cabbage Patch dolls?
I can't believe the most notable, interesting thing about 1983 for you involved seatbelts.
I haven't finished yet. The final episode of MASH aired with 125 million viewers. Microsoft Word was released. And Kim Jong-un, Chris Hemsworth and Kim Clijsters were born.
What a trio.
What a
list. Not often mentioned in the same breath, but ought to be.
Yeah, and in the tennis world,
two famous Kims.
We were about to
hang on. You said Kim Jong Un.
Is that wrong?
No, I'm just checking. He's the one that is rumored to be currently, and for the foreseeable future, deceased. Right?
Yeah, but I think those rumors were, well, I mean, what can you believe coming out of there? But I think they were unsubstantiated,
oh,
weren't
right.
they?
Okay. Have we I seen a so. Photo of him with today's paper?
I think there was video of him.
Oh, right.
He was born in 1983. That much we do know. And in 1983, Yannick Noah had his moment. He'd been discovered by Arthur Ashe in a tour of Cameroon where Noah spent his formative years. And at the age of 23, Noah had been a professional player for quite a while by that time. But he'd never had a run like he would have at Roland Garros. No French man had won the French Open title since Marcel Bernard in 1946. No man has done it since. So let's hear all about it from the man himself. Yannick, take it away.
My dream, my ultimate dream, you know, as a child growing up in Paris, in France, I actually stayed 1 year as a tennis student in Roland Garros, dreaming on this empty center court about just playing there one day. Beginning of the late 70s, I moved to Paris. So I was from Paris. My family was living in Paris. My friends were in Paris, but my ultimate goal was to just win this. And, this year after 83, we started in March with my coach Patrice, and we had a chat and we said, okay, now from now on, we're going to do everything we can just thinking about this goal, winning this. So we had 3 months. So we started out, you know, practicing a lot. I was playing great tennis. We went to Monte Carlo, win the first round, second round, third round. I'm playing Manolo Orantes. Manolo then was like 36. You know, it was for me an easy game to win. So I'm at the hotel, 11 o'clock, and of course my friends are calling me, Yannick, what are you doing? We're in Monte Carlo. It's party time. So I'm like, well, I have a game tomorrow at 12, you know, oh, it's okay. You know, you wake up at 8, you just come for a little, you know, just come. So I said, okay, I'll come for one drink. It's okay. So I end up staying late, way too late. And I said, okay, it's okay. You know, I'll sleep tomorrow night. You know, I'll be ready for the semifinal. So I play Manolo, win the first set, I believe, and then lose because I got tired. And it was very, very embarrassing. So Patrice Agelor, my coach, came to me and said, Yannick, you know, okay, you really screwed up. I don't want to be your coach. I'd rather stay your friends, but I cannot work like that. We've been working already for 3 full weeks, and you know, I heard that you went out last night, so I cannot work with this. So I'd say to him, Patrick, I'm really embarrassed. You know, I swear from now on, let's go, let's do it. You know, I'm really embarrassed. And he went, okay. So I just had finished the game like half hour ago before. So we went right away. He said, okay, so take your rackets. We're going to go practice for another 3 hours. So we went to practice right away. And then from then on, I went to work as I never did in my life. And then, and here we come, you know, I went to play Madrid. I won Madrid. First, I played Lisbon. I lost to Mats in the finals. I was up 6-4, 5-4 and lost it in the finals in Lisbon. I went to play, Madrid, I win Madrid. I go to play Hamburg. I win Hamburg, beating two good clay court players then. You know, it was Mats and José Higueras. And then I had a week off, and then came the French, and I played, you know, I played, I was ready.
You sure were. You had a match, I believe, against Ivan Lendl.
Yes.
That fortnight.
Yes.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I always liked to play Ivan because Ivan was a better player, but I liked to play him because we grew up as juniors together. He was always 1-2. I was 1, he was 2, but he was always Ivan and Yannick since we've been like in, you know, 14 years old. So he was always like this competition between us, competition of style, of, you know, everything. We were like so different, but with, you know, some respect. So I was really, he was pushing me up, you know, and when I was playing him, I was always, because I liked his game, I could read his game. So I was always playing well against him for some reason. And even though he won, you know, he was number one, he became like one of the best, the greats. I never got to his level, but when I was playing him, I was always like playing great matches. So I was ready. I played him. I was playing him in the quarterfinals. I was very excited by the game. So I win the first set, I believe 6-3 or 6-4. I was the first two sets quite easily. I'm up 5-3, I believe, in the third. And then he serves and, you know, he was like so upset. He was like, you know, acting like he was giving up and tanking. So match point, you know, 15-40 serve, you know, he served a second serve and he's come to the net. He was never come to the net, never serve and volley. He come to the net like walking. So I just push it back thinking he's going to just, you know, give it back to me. And he just make a little, you know, nice little volley, you know, 30-40 match, second match point, second match point. He does the same. I return, better return, but he makes a, you know, decent volley winner. Okay. I said, okay, fine. So at that point, you know, the energy like changed. The whole stadium started to like, I could feel the tension. I could feel the nervousness. I just went into a black hole. I couldn't think. I just realized like I had too much points 2 minutes ago. Back to 5-4. I serve. I don't even remember what I did. 5-all. The next thing I know, it's 2-1. And I was completely in a black tunnel. I didn't know where I was. I couldn't think. Totally disturbed. I'm serving the first game of the fourth. I'm serving love 15, love 30, love 40. The you know, I'm playing home, so the people are just, ooh, wow, what's going on? I can feel it. It's like, it was a terrible feeling. And for some reason, I don't know how, I won this game. And from then on, I just came out of my tunnel. And I end up winning this set 6-love for some reason. So it was like, I saw death from so close that, you know, it was like, okay, you died, Yannick, but you have another chance to come back. So I said, okay, now this chance, I don't let it go. So I won this set and then I end up winning the game and the match.
And I think virtually every player who's ever won a Grand Slam has had a moment like that at least once in a tournament where it could have gone the other way and things might have gone badly. And yet you beat Lendl and you were supposed to play, if the rankings were to be believed, Jimmy Connors, who you'd always struggled against. And yet he wasn't there.
Yeah, he wasn't there. I always had trouble with Jimmy because Jimmy had this way of playing and he was hitting the balls. He was not giving this top spin and you could hit the ball, you know, over your hips and on your, you know, above your hips and the shoulders, high balls. He was always like these low balls. His heavy shot he hits was always close to the net. So you really had to play under the belt always. And I didn't like that. And he played Christophe Roger Vasselin and Christophe Roger Vasselin played the match of his life and beat him. And that was like the best surprise. You know, I was like so relieved not to play Jimmy. And, because I had Christophe, I know Christophe, we grew up together. I never lost to him, but I had his game. So it was so funny because my problem then was, okay, you still have a semifinal to play. You know, you have a couple, you know, 1 or 2 days to prepare for the semifinals. So don't think about the final. Just think about Christophe. That was like the main thing, to really focus on Christophe, because I was so excited. I said, okay, I'm in the finals. I mean, I'm in the finals already before even playing. And Patrice really helped me then. And I played a really serious game. Really, I didn't miss many. I didn't miss anything. I was in such a good shape, you know. I just had lost one set in the whole tournament, so, and I really destroyed him, you know. It was terrible, because at some point I was actually hoping that he would play better, because I was playing great and he was not playing well at all. He was still in, you know, overwhelmed by the win that he had against Jimmy, and I could see him on TV all day long, you know, giving interviews, how you beat Jimmy before the game, Jimmy. And I said, oh, I remember like once I was practicing and he came to practice the day before the game, our semifinal. He came to practice at the racing club in Paris, and he came and he had like probably like 3 cameras, a crews around him, like following him on the court. So I said, oh, Jesus, how can he focus? How can he concentrate? And he was mentally, he was totally drained, totally mentally tired for my for our game. So he played a terrible game. I played a great game, and you know I beat him very easily. Mm.
6-3, 6-love, 6-love. And I just wonder, though, Yannick, you have dreamed about this moment. You're about to go into the final at Roland Garros. So many players have tried and failed since. And I wonder how you felt the day, the night before you stepped out there against Mats Wilander.
Well, I was, you know, we were, I was staying in my country house with my dad. You know, we didn't want, you know, to have anybody else in the house. I was staying with my dad for the whole tournament, so it would be quiet. And we went back to the home. We had an early dinner and, you know, I was really relaxed. I was looking for the game. I had played Mats a couple weeks before, 3 weeks before in Hamburg, and I beat him. So I was very confident. I used to love to play Mats. And I went to sleep and for the first time, and it was the last time, I dreamt about the whole match. I dreamt the whole match. First set, I lose. Second set, I win. Third set, I win. Fourth set, I lose. Fifth set starts. And I lose the game. And I lost it. And I'm like totally destroyed. I remember crying. I remember it was like so clear, this dream. And I, you know, I hear a sound and it's my dad, you know, and I say, Jesus. And I was in bed. I just lost the game. You know, I felt like I was Monday and I lost the game. And dad said, well, hey, what's happening? Did you sleep well? And I slept for eight straight hours. And he goes, you ready? And I'm like, I still have my body just feels like, oh, I just lost, you know, you're dead. You know, I'm flat dead. And he goes, you ready? You slept well? And then I realized that actually I didn't play the game. The dream was so real. So I was like, wow, a second chance. Oh, this time I'm not going to make the same mistakes as I did like a few hours ago. And I was so fired up. It was like having, you know, after that I was working, you know, when I became a coach, I was like working with visualization, images, yoga. And it was like a natural visualization and like super intense trip. And I came on the court. Everything that happened during the match was kind of a déjà vu. It was déjà vu. But I also knew, so we went, warm up, but I knew that was the game of my life. You know, it was a beautiful day. I all my family was there, all of my family, all my friends, everybody, all the people that, you know, helped me during the game. Arthur was there commenting for the TV. He was not missing one person. Everybody was like, so the energy was like so perfect, perfect day. I was really hoping for a beautiful day because as I was like the attacking player against Mats, you know, it's always better to have like, you know, warm conditions. The balls are faster. The court is faster. And I knew it was the game of my life. And as we were like behind the curtain before coming up to the court, I remembered praying, and I never prayed in my life. I never prayed. I prayed. And then after the prayer, I remember the feeling that I had was like, I'd rather die than coming out of this court without the cup. It was the feeling that I had. I was totally into the game, heart and soul for this game. It never happened to me after I played. I won some matches, never won a Grand Slam, won some tournaments, but never did I have this thing. It was like a spiritual thing. It was 100% me, Yannick, tennis player, for this match. I was ready to give everything, including dying. You know, I was ready to die for this one. And then it happened.
It sure did. 6-2, 7-5, 7-6. I watched some of the match back before we started speaking, and a couple of things that really struck me. One is your approach to the match, the relentlessness of your charging to the net. Now, I know you did a lot of time you were at the net in your career, but was this unusually aggressive?
Yes. Well, you know, Mats was giving me the opportunity. You know, after this game, I talked to Mats. Mats is like my friend, and we talked about this. You know, we're always laughing because when it comes to Paris, even though he won 3 times the French Open and won 7 Grand Slam, we used to do some exhibitions of charity matches, and every time we play, they introduce him at the finalist of the finalist of Roland Garros 83. That was so funny. Oh, but anyway, so we talked, and he said after this game he realized that, you know, he had to change his game, and he became more aggressive. And this is when he became another player. He was more aggressive, you know, behind his first serve. He could come to the net. He could attack. He was just, you know, not the player that was when in the 81, 82, 83 before this game. And, but then when I played, he was basically staying in the back and trying to pass you, daring you to come to the net and just trying to pass you. And that was just perfect because, he was exactly the kind of game that I really liked. And for me, attacking was the only way. I liked it. I loved attacking. I loved being at the net. It was my territory. I loved it.
Yeah. You, on match point, I remember the match point and the way you finished it, and then you immediately turn and seem to look for your dad in the crowd, and he is there. Just talk us through that moment.
Well, you know, when you play, and when I especially when you play at home, because we have this luxury, this privilege as French, to play at home. You know, we're playing at home. When I played on this court and I played for 10 years, I know exactly who is where. You know, I know where is my family, of course. I know where are my friends. I know where is these beautiful chicks that I saw the other day. I know, I take all the good energies. I know where everybody is. And of course, you know, I knew where my parents were. And, you know, then, you know, I used to ask my players when I was a captain, why do you want to win? And they say, well, you know, the first time, say, yeah, well, we want to win because we want to win the Davis Cup. I say, yeah, but why do you want to win the Davis Cup? And sometimes they didn't have an answer. I told them, and this is what we play for: the people who sacrificed so much for us. We play for them. When we win for them. This is our, the way we can like give back. This is their reward. Like we win for them. We win for the people we love. We win for our fans. We win, but most of all, the people who've been like I sacrificed my childhood, you know, being with my parents just to be there at this moment. And, but that was like in my subconscious. I couldn't put words into it. And, so I win this match point and, I couldn't think, you know, I barely shook Matt's, you know, hand. I forgot to shake Jacques Dorfman's, the referee's hand. And I just saw my dad jumping, you know, from the stands. And I lost it. And we just started crying. And I was saying, we won, you know, and, crying. And, you know, he said, I love you. It's the first time ever my dad told me he loves me. I knew he did, but he never told me, you know, we had to go that far. And, this moment changed my life. It just changed my whole life because not that was just the last French player won the French Open. It was just that the emotion was so strong and so pure. I think the last French that won the French Open before was 37 years ago. People were so happy, like everybody were crying. People were crying in front of their TV. And, you know, it was like the best emotion possible. How many times you cry of happiness in the arms of your father? You know, if you're lucky to do it once, you know, you're the lucky man or lucky girl. You know, you never cry of happiness. You know, you cry of sadness, of melancholy, or, you know, sometimes you can have some tears, but like cry, hugging your father in front of millions of people. So since then, you know, I went into, you know, all these French people's heart, you know, and that's the best way to go and, you know, get into people's, you know, heart, you know, so it was the best door. And to that day, people always talk to me about it. Always. Every time, every day, if I walk in France somewhere, someone's going to tell me, Yannick, I remember where I was. It was such a beautiful day. We were with the family. We jumped up and down in front of the TV. We started crying. You know, we hugged each other. And it was really, really the most emotional thing I ever lived. And I did it in front of millions. And the best part, because sometimes you can say, oh, I remember one day I cried of happiness, you know, in the arms of my parents, you know, but the good part is that I have it on tape. I have it on tape and I can show my children, you know, I can show it. And it's funny because the first time Joakim won the NCAA tournament with the Gators, as a basketball player, he won and he was like, the first thing he did was to walk up the stands and came to hug us.
Oh,
his mother was like, it was the best day. It was like the best day, like for my child to do it too. It was like just amazing. So this is history. You know, it was like a moment that we know, obviously I will never forget. You know, it was like, you know, people always remember. And if I sometimes forget, of course, I'm not here thinking about it all the time, but people remind me of this time always with a good smile. And that's it. That was my French Open. If I had won Wimbledon, which I never came close to, but maybe the US or the Australian Open, it wouldn't have been the same at all. I won at home. And after that, you know, I had it all. You know, I was not motivated to have another one. I never got this fire. I was working hard, but I never had this extra fire that was almost, you know, I was telling you, like almost spiritual, you know, it was a question of living or dying. Never had this after that because I achieved it. I achieved everything I wanted. If I'd won maybe before the Australian Open, or the US Open, maybe I would have tried to go for another one because my goal was to win the French Open. And he went beyond, you know, because my dad coming and everybody, you know, the whole energy was like so perfect. You know, it couldn't be better. It was a dream.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. So, Catherine, it was a dream. And he makes you feel every moment of that dream, I feel, including the dream he had the night before the final when he thought he hadn't won.
He makes you feel like you're in the dream with him. In fact, my dream is for Yannick Noah to record some sort of meditation tapes, because just his voice lulls me into a very dreamlike, happy state. It's the most magical voice in sport. I mean, as I was listening to that, I was thinking, I wonder what kind of dream Matt's had the night before. Imagine if both of them usually you hear stories of athletes having a dream where they, you know, visualize themselves winning, but actually he had a dream that he didn't want to come to fruition, which is quite a sort of slight divergence from the trope of visionary athlete dreams. God, he's something, isn't he? He's mesmerizing. I mean, and the honesty of him, the way he talked about how relieved he was that he didn't have to face Jimmy Connors in the semifinals. I loved that. I loved him saying, I already thought I was in the final. and that doesn't make you think, oh, you arrogant, who do you think you are? He just believed in himself and was right to do so. I feel transported to a time when I wasn't even alive, and that's, gosh, what a superpower that is that he's got.
I don't normally believe in fate or things happening for a reason, really, or, you know, that kind of trope, it was meant to be. But to hear him describe the series of events, you know, the how he had trained harder that year, how he liked playing Lendl and beat him, how Connors got out of the way, how Ash was there, his father was there, it was all perfect. He lulls you in. He turns rational, logical thinkers into people who believe in mystery and spirituality, and it's kind of a placebo effect he has on people. And I think that's why he's been such a successful Davis Cup captain and Fed Cup captain. He changes the energy in a room when he walks in, and he sort of lulls you into thinking like he thinks. And yeah, he just has an effect on people, which is difficult to put your finger on, but it's just there whenever he speaks.
I've never met anybody like him. And the first time I ever met him was 1998, when I joined the ATP as a pretty green, young 25-year-old, as I was then. And I was dealing with Borg and McEnroe at a champions event in Doha. And it was pretty intimidating, to be honest, to try to deal with these people that I'd watched as a kid. And Noah immediately put me at ease. That was the beauty of his way, his demeanor. He makes you feel like you're the only person in the room that he's interested in hearing from at any one time. And I didn't know him at all. And yet he kind of made you feel like he cared about what you were saying, the sort of things you were asking him to do. And getting into a conversation with him socially, He was totally invested in whatever was being said, or at least that's how he made you feel. And he could do it on a wider scale as well. Whether it was a room full of people that he was addressing, it felt like he was talking to all of you. If he would take the mic and start singing or playing music, let's make it clear here, he had a more successful music career than he had a tennis career after he'd finished. It's just incredible what he achieved in the music world. And then in a stadium like what we've just watched, the tennis that he played to win that Grand Slam title, the only Grand Slam title that he ever won. We've just witnessed that. And he had everybody eating out of his hand. Whatever he felt, they felt. And even 22 years after first meeting him, and I've only seen him once one-on-one, I think, in between that time. I interviewed him briefly in 2010 at a tournament you and I were both at, Catherine, in Paris. And I remember him seeing me then, and he wouldn't have known my name, but he saw me and he remembered who I was by sight. And he makes you feel very, very warm, that there's warmth there. And here we are another 10 years on, and we got to speak to him via a friend of ours who knows Mansour Bahrami, who called Yannick Noah and arranged for us to speak to him. And when I called him up, he couldn't place where it was. He thought it was 25 years ago that we last saw each other. And yet he just makes you feel like he's got all the time in the world for you. I asked for 45 minutes to speak to him. He spoke for 90. And I had to I had to stop the interview because I'd got to do something else by that time. And we will have that full interview for you in a few weeks' time. You will just hang on every word is all I can say. I listen to it and I feel like I'm holding my breath while I'm listening. I'm hanging on every word. Most of it I'm trying to suppress laughter or tears or shock. Just the way he can tell a story. And maybe he could have achieved more in the game, but frankly, who cares? He left you with that moment.
Do you remember he didn't even play that Champions Tour event, David? It was there had been a Champions Tour event in Paris for a number of years on the clay at the racing club, but that was the one year it was held indoor at the Stade Coubertin, where they used to have the WTA event there, and that was the same event where there was the McEnroe Lendl moment that we've described on the pod, and I'm sure we'll come back to tomorrow because we're reliving their French Open final on Monday. But they obviously desperately wanted Yannick Noah to play this event. It was his 50th birthday that week, I believe. Do you remember any of this?
I do, and he's just turned 60.
Yeah, and they got him to just show up and walk on the court and accept an enormous birthday cake. that's all he did. He was there for one day, waved, and said thank you very much for this enormous birthday cake, and it was the best moment of the week. It was just absolutely electric, and you know, I wish I could have seen him play. But seeing him hold a birthday cake aloft, being cheered on by thousands of people was pretty special. And then,
what did you think of the tennis you've just witnessed from that final? I mean, unfortunately, it's one of those matches that we don't have the full complete match, but we've seen some highlights of his run to that title and his dad running on the court. And what did you think of it?
I was struck by exactly the same thing it seems you were, that you referenced in that interview, how aggressive he was, what a net rusher he was. I hadn't quite realised that about him. And just, I love seeing, we talked about it with Martina Navratilova on the clay. Again, spoiler alert, something we'll be discussing over the next week or so. The commitment to come to the net on clay is something really magnetic to watch, especially when it's against somebody like Verlander, where you've got this immense contrast. And Verlander just looked stumped, didn't he, by the whole experience. He looked just at a bit of a loss, both by, I guess, by the sort of the magnetism of what was down the other end of the court, but also by his style of play. I was also struck by how immensely cool his T-shirt was and how immensely uncool it would look on almost every other human being, because it was a polo with a collar that's open at the down to sort of the mid chest, and it didn't even have buttons giving you the option to cover up your chest should you wish. And of course, he looked fabulous. But just imagining that on anybody else, they'd look a prat.
I won't try. Matt, in another life, pre-tennis podcast, you had studied Yannick Noah.
Yeah, I think everyone's kind of got a Yannick Noah connection, as the way he told, you know, he entered people's hearts in that day in Paris, and I think it's impossible to overstate how popular he is in France. You know, he's cross-generational, as you said, David, because of the way he's become such a successful artist and singer and performer, and young people know him for that, really. Anyway, I was living in France on my year abroad in 2016, and we had to do an essay, and had absolutely no idea what to write about. And then I got a copy of L'Équipe one morning, and he was on the front as the Davis Cup captain. He'd just been reinstated, and I thought, oh, I wonder if I could wangle my way to writing about tennis for my year abroad project. Why don't I do something on Yannick Noah? And, you know, I discussed with my supervisor, can I do it on why he's culturally important in France? And they said, yes, go ahead. And suddenly I just discovered all this stuff about him, which all kind of goes back to 1983 when he won Roland Garros, because that was, and this, I'm going to move into our sport and history crossover here. That was a really important year in French history, 1983, because the country was kind of at a little bit of a crossroads about what it wanted to be as a nation. On the one hand, you had a march for equality against racism, which took place from October to December. It was the first kind of anti-racist movement of its kind. And that came about, unfortunately, because on the other hand, there were by-elections in a French commune in Dreux in northern France, where the National Front actually won the first round of elections for the first time. So you had this divided country between, you know, anti-racism and racism, to be honest. And in the middle, you had Yannick Noah winning Roland Garros. So here was this, you know, Franco-Cameroon sensation who, on one hand, symbolized the France that people wanted France to be, and on the other hand, France that people didn't want the country to be. And therefore, his win was just so culturally important. He was at the forefront of social change, really. And, you know, he was kind of politicized after that. Presidents talked about him symbolizing France. They wanted to use him to gain support. I think Mitterrand went with him on a trip back to Cameroon. You know, so he just became this incredibly important figure that went just beyond his tennis. And that's why today his kind of legend has endured. Obviously, it's endured because no other French man has won a Grand Slam since. He's kind of their Fred Perry, if you like. You know, and that name endured in British culture for so long before Andy Murray. And it's the same with Yannick Noah. He just gets talked about, and it all began with this match that we've watched, 1983.
And did he embrace all of that, Matt?
Certainly not to begin with. He I think he fell into a little bit of a depression, actually, after Roland Garros 1983. He couldn't quite deal with the fame and the reality of it all. And he actually moved to the United States because the pressure of living in France, he was their star. And the pressure was a little too much. But I think as the years have gone on, I think a lot of his music is quite political and social, and he's kind of embraced it through that. But at the time, it was certainly hard for him.
Oh, it's great background.
History plus sport. Yes, please.
Yep.
That's what I'm here for.
That's what we're all here for, here on Roland Garros Relived. And that is our first of 15 of these that we're going to be bringing you over the next couple of weeks during what should have been the French Open fortnight. Also, just a couple of little bits of sad news that we've received over the last few days. Ashley Cooper, the four-time Grand Slam champion, passed away on Friday, aged 83, an Australian who won in 1958 the Australian Open, Wimbledon and the US Open championships, passed away and will be sadly missed by many. Rod Laver said of his fellow Australian, "So sad to hear of Ashley's passing. He was a wonderful champion on and off the court, and what a backhand. So many cherished memories. Farewell, my friend." And also, Kathy Sabin has passed away. She was the first female president of the LTA, and somebody that I came across a few times and was just the loveliest person, and I know she'll be very sadly missed as well. So we're going to be back tomorrow with another edition of Tennis Relived here on the Tennis Podcast, when we are going to be, as Catherine said, looking back at John McEnroe trying to win the French Open, the elusive French Open, up against Ivan Lendl, who'd never won a Grand Slam title in his life to that point. On Tuesday, we're going to be looking back at Chris Evert against Martina Navratilova from 1985 at the French Open. Catherine has been speaking to Chris Evert. You'll be hearing that here on the Tennis Podcast. We can't wait for that. We've got Mary Carrillo talking us through the John McEnroe she knew back in the 80s and what that entire moment in time meant to John McEnroe. So that's coming your way tomorrow here on the Tennis Podcast. Thank you for listening to us today, and we'll speak to you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.